Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hello, old friends. I'm Brian Brinkman.
I'm David Goldstein. The date is November 22nd, 2021. The Monday before Thanksgiving, you're probably gearing up to hopefully eat some turkey and sides and stuffing and pumpkin pie and all that cliched stuff with your family. Before you can get to there, you gotta listen to The Drop.
Might be my favorite week of the year. I don't know. I feel like I say that every week, but like Thanksgiving week, what memories this brings back. I feel like the Monday and Tuesday before Thanksgiving is just this kind of slow crawl through the work week until you get to the point where you can just relax. You can throw on Planes, Trains, and Automobiles for the first of 10 times of the weekend. You start to smell what's cooking in the kitchen. My wife usually starts making her green bean casserole. Start getting all the mirepoix ready for the stuffing. Start the brine for the turkey. You know, you have some autumnal music, some singer-songwriter music playing in the background. Just an incredible, incredible time of the year. I'm so excited. How are you doing, Dave?
Pretty good. I've always enjoyed this week as well. For, I think, about 35 years, we'd go to my grandparents in Roslyn, New York, in Nassau County, Long Island. However, they're no longer with us. So then one year we went to my aunt and uncle's apartment. One year we stayed here. We're kind of sort of figuring out what we want the new tradition to be. And this year, because of COVID, we're not all going to gather. I'm just going to go with my family to see my parents in Connecticut, which will be plenty pleasant. I'll eat. I'll watch football. I'll probably maybe have some scotch with my dad.
That sounds good. Yeah, we used to go to my uncle's house, who's no longer with us, and he had just like this amazing house in the woods in the northwest suburbs of Chicago, up in Barrington, and it was the best place to go and celebrate Thanksgiving. It just felt like Thanksgiving when you walked in the door. It was the first place I ever had my first drink. It was the first place I ever had my first toke off a joint. was the first place I listened to like every good record I've ever listened to in my entire life. We used to have bonfires around their pond in the back. Just felt like Thanksgiving. And we try to recreate that vibe as best as possible in our house. It's going to be kind of a chilled out Thanksgiving this year. My sister and her boyfriend are coming over. I think my brother might come over as well, assuming he's not traveling. So just kind of low key, have a good time.
So how are your Chicago Bulls doing?
Well, David, it's a really good question. We are recording this on Wednesday, November 17th. We have a game this evening against the Portland Trail Blazers, and I am going to go see the Bulls for the first time in 6 years. I want to say, I think the last time I saw them was when I was living in Annapolis.
Wow.
I'm going to go see them play the Denver Nuggets, which should be a fantastic game, Friday night. We had a horrible loss to the Golden State Warriors last Friday in San Francisco. Kind of a predictable loss, but exposed a number of flaws for the team. And I expected that we were about to just see LLL pile up over the course of the road trip. But instead, we won back-to-back games in Staples Center. Now, I think it's going to be called Crypto.com Arena, something like that.
The Crypto.com, yeah. That's that's emblematic of a whole bunch of bad issues with America, but yeah.
It is. But we hadn't won back-to-back games there since the 2011-2012 season, the lockout-shortened season where we were the number one seed and then Derrick Rose tore his ACL 47 minutes into game one of the playoffs. I'm still not okay. But we won the back-to-back games. No LeBron, no Kawhi. I get it. But
doesn't
it was
matter.
Way better than I expected. We played incredible basketball to hold a lead in the first game against the Clippers and then to maintain and just accelerate a lead in the second game against the Lakers. So I feel incredibly optimistic about this team, way more than I expected. We're going to see where things go. I will say this, okay, for all of our listeners out here, I try to be as fair and balanced as possible, even though I have my inherent biases. I did not expect Zach LaVine and DeMar DeRozan to gel this quickly and this well. They seem to really love playing together, and they both seem to be giving enough to each other while taking enough from each other. And it's just like, so far, it's proven to be some great basketball. But how are you feeling about your Knicks? I watched a great Knicks game the other night.
Yeah, that was a game against the Pacers that they won. They came alive in the fourth quarter, largely thanks to their bench. Derrick Rose, Emmanuel Quickly, being IQ. They're an interesting team to watch. They're quite lovable. I keep saying good veteran leadership, very good young role players that are going to really help them in the coming years. Their starting five has been lousy defensively. Like, they're actually, the starting five is very, like, negative point differential, but the bench has been lights out. So it's kind of been waiting for the bench to come and save the starting five, which is not really how it's supposed to work. But good win against the Pacers. Right now they're 8-6. They play the 3-11 Orlando Magic tonight, which is at the Garden, which is a game they kind of have to win. I suspect that they will. The Magic are in rebuilding mode. But one of those three Magic wins came against the Knicks. So who knows? Crazier things have happened. Well, but no, right now they're a very enjoyable team to watch, and given what Knicks fans have had to deal with over the past 10 decades, I will take that any day of the week.
Bulls and Knicks are still these like scrappy 4-7 seeds that like you really love and have no business being the marquee teams in two of the marquee cities in the NBA. But I think we deal with it with how we can. And I think you and I both know the ceilings that these teams have while also having enough room to be pleasantly surprised when things go really well.
Absolutely. You seen any rock shows lately?
Coming off of Tonstartbandt, I think is how you pronounce it.
Bandit. I know who you're talking like about. Yeah.
They were amazing. They put out a record, Petunia, about a month ago. Dave sent to me, literally, I was like brushing my teeth in a motel in Phoenix, Arizona, about to hit the road to head to Chula Vista. and said, wow, this is like one of the most interesting records I've heard all year. And I put it on my drive and it blew me away. And decided to go and see them when I saw that they were playing in Denver just a couple weeks later. Got to go with friends of the pod, Ryan Smith, as well as on Twitter, Queen City Jams. Very good dude. They played on a three-band bill. They closed out the show. Paul Jacobs opened up, a really cool Montreal-based band that I dug their show. And the opening band was a local band called Wally, which I told my son that I was going to see a band named Wally, and he goes, that's stupid. So that's him. Maybe it's the after effects of the first dose of Pfizer that he got that made him not thrilled by a band naming themselves after him. But how about you? Have you seen any shows lately?
Big ups to the first dose of Pfizer, Wally. Last week I saw Garcia People show again at the Sultan Room. They were doing, it was the third night of their residency. I cannot go tonight because I'm single dadding it for another few days. But excellent show. I was actually able to record that show. I brought my recorder, and if you want to find it, November 10th, 2021, Garcia Peoples, it's up on Archive. Archive may have had one of the songs out of order. I know I post the proper song list in the notes, but good show. That came out well. I was happy that I could do it, and I'm happy that Garcia Peoples continue to kick ass. I think they just released another single from their forthcoming album. So you can hear basically what's side A of the forthcoming Dodge and Dews record. I would highly recommend that. But you've got some other things coming up this Sunday, though, correct?
Yeah, when this episode goes live, I will be coming off of night one of two of Goose's tour closing run at the Mission Ballroom here in Denver, Colorado.
Wait, they're closing the tour on a Monday night?
Closing the tour on a Monday night. It's a very 90s Fish move. I think that they... If I recall correctly, they put the Sunday show up solo, and it did not sell out, but it sold initial tickets really quick. And just like they did over the summer, where I believe they announced one show and then added another, they realized, oh man, demand is pretty high. Let's add another show. The strange thing is Monday has sold out, the tour finale, but Sunday has not sold out yet.
People don't like seeing Sunday night shows. Sunday is for like... watching Succession and Curb Your Enthusiasm and just being in bed by 11 o'clock. So I can totally get that.
I get it too. There's usually one band and one band only that will drag me out on a Sunday night, and that's Fish. But as we know, if we were to expose the private DMs between you, myself, and one Josh Carver, we are all pretty into this band Goose, and so I will devote a Sunday night happily to them based on the way they're playing, and I'm really excited. They seem to really like Denver. This is their second tour in a row, closing out in Denver, Colorado, and they're doing a show on Friday night at Belly Up in Aspen, which kind of seems to be like, you know, the jam band royalty. If you're passing through Denver at any point in the wintry months, you need to play Belly Up at some point. So I'm really excited to see him. It'll be my first time at the Mission Ballroom since I saw Wilco there in November of 2019, which was a fantastic show. The Mission is this just incredible step-up venue from, you know, they played Cervantes back in 2019, which is like a big bar, and now they're playing the Mission. Really, the next step at this point in time, if you were to continue to grow in Denver, is like the Pepsi Center. I don't know how close they are to playing that, but this seems like a really good spot for them at this point in their career. It's been a really good tour thus far, so I'm very excited to see what happens. What have your thoughts been so far?
Yeah, I've certainly enjoyed it. It kind of segued once, I should say, not segued, more like dovetailed the Fish tour. Once Fish got done with the Halloween Vegas shows, it was kind of like Goose tour. Kick back into gear. It's been, you know, it's fun to see a band like that, how they progress, how they do things differently, how things change from tour to tour. But I'd say, the most recent one has been enjoyable. I have especially enjoyed, they played a show on November 10th in Houston, Texas. The second set opened with, I think it was like a 25-minute version of their song, Wisteria Lane, which kind of gets to it really quickly, and towards like the last 6 minutes, it's very effortless kind of bass-driven groove that I don't want to say sounded like Phish, but more kind of like the spirit of Phish, and that it's kind of like the band playing itself, that the music plays itself, and it's the kind of enjoyable communication that you've come to expect from kind of like an upper-tier jam band. I mean, for me, there still isn't a ton of variation in the jamming from night to night. They're still learning how to craft sets, but kind of everything I've seen up to this point makes me feel like an evolutionary leap will occur at like some point in the not too distant future.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. And I think, you know, it's going to be interesting to hear parts of this fall tour in comparison to the summer tour. I think that where we're at right now, and we'll see what the next couple of shows bring, but where we're at right now, the summer tour for Goose was the strongest I've heard of the band in terms of crafting full shows, full sets, but also, you know, this kind of jamming breakthrough that seemed to happen with the All I Need from the Suwannee Festival. There was a tendency, we've talked about it before, with Goose Jams to very quickly move into that like bliss space where Rick would just take over soloing, the band would build on a major key, and then like, you know, that tension and release moment would happen and everybody would celebrate. It sounded really great. It was awesome to experience. And I think from this year, the best example of that has to be the Arcadia from 611. Just an incredible, incredible jam.
Yeah, still my all-time favorite Goose jam.
So it's interesting because 4 days later, they play the 30-minute Western Sun, which is my all-time favorite Goose jam, and kind of showcases the opposite of where the band can go. It's this like minimalistic approach. It's very melodic, but like, you know, there's a huge emphasis on Ben's playing. Rick plays in like kind of like muted tones, and they kind of let the jam slowly build. And we've heard that throughout this year. To me, if I think about Goose 2021, that is the biggest accomplishment of this year, is figuring out how to jam in a style that allows them to get into a bit of a darker space, a little bit of a weirder space, showcase some diversity. Because I'm right there with you. I think that we're still in, if you want to make the Phish comparison, we're in like 92, 93, parts of 94, in terms of a band that has really, really great moments, but has a hard time still putting together like a full show that you have to press play on and walk away, let it run for 3 hours. I will shout out that 11:10 show you talked about. That second set might be the best second set I've ever heard from the band. Like 25-minute Wisteria Lane, 18-minute Earthling or Alien, a song I don't particularly love, but has an incredible jam associated with it. The second, My Generation, in 2 weeks, which moves into a fantastic jam, a fantastic ballad break with Your Ocean, and then it closes with an absolutely incredible version of Tumble. 5 songs, really fluid. Regardless of song selection, the band just sounds like they are tapped into something higher than themselves during that second set, and I absolutely love it.
Yeah, definitely just quickly going back to what you said about the timeline relative to Phish, yeah, I'd say like 1992 in the sense that they're on the verge of something big and that the shows are still good enough top to bottom to warrant seeing, you know, multiple shows in a run. It's still, you can certainly get excited you can get excited from night to night to see where they're going to take it. Still somewhat samey from evening to evening. But yeah, I don't think they've quite gotten to like this August 1993, November 1994 apex yet. But like I said, it's within reach.
Before we close this out, though, and we are both very, very excited about where Goose is headed, what jams do you recommend from this fall tour?
Certainly, I already mentioned the November 10th Wisteria Lane. Check that out. The next night, they closed the first set with a version of their song Madhavan. That's is a very interesting roller coaster ride of a song. So those are the two I have. Definitely check those out. That's kind of like the litmus test for whether or not you can dig this band.
Yeah, I'd go back to the 11:06 show in Atlanta, which was one of my favorite shows of the overall tour. First set closes out with just an incredible slow ready segue into Arcadia. Really cool segue out of Slow Ready. Just like they end up in Arcadia in such an incredible way. And then the Rosewood Heart from the second set. That and the Wisteria are probably my two favorite jams of the tour. But I would also add the 11-12 drive into Slow Tumble, which opens that show in Austin, I believe it is. And, you know, they get through the song drive, they do the initial jam out of drive, and then they shift gears into this very, very beautiful space that sounded really unique, sounded like some sort of like new ideas kind of being uncovered by them. So really, really enjoyed that.
Yeah, the Rosewood Heart jam is excellent enough to look past the fact that they also play a 10-minute version of a David Gray cover in that set, which...
such a fitting cover.
Yeah, that's kind of like you get the highs and the lows of Goose right there. They'll drop a David Gray cover and then follow it up with a 20.
I love it. It's so good. It's so fitting for them.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of fitting the British, early 2000s British Dave Matthews equivalent that Goose would enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, like they can play, you know, like a Phil Collins cover, like an 80s Peter Gabriel cover, just like they can play David Gray. Like it just, that kind of synthy soft rock works very, very well for what Goose does, and I'm very much here for it.
So lastly, before we get to our next section, we would be remiss if we did not celebrate a birthday, a 30th birthday. U2's Octung Baby turns 30 this week. Want to feel old? My goodness. I think it's getting the deluxe vinyl reissue on two LPs. I think you can get it colored, or for a little less money, you can get it without the red and blue colors if you like. And then there's a digital version that comes out the first week of December. I think allegedly has 22 unreleased songs for the digital version. And I know it's easy to talk smack about Spotify, but when it comes to listening to bonus tracks on reissues, it can't be beat. I think I'll probably listen to each of those 22 songs once and then say, okay, I get it. And I'll go back to listen to Octung Baby.
Yeah, Octung Baby. I could speak for 30 minutes and then have way more to say about this album. I will just summarize it very briefly. This is the most important album I've ever heard in my entire life. It completely changed the way I understood and heard music at the age of 6. And I've never been the same since the first moment that I heard like completely changed my mind, completely changed my life. And I'll be forever grateful for this record. And the fact that it's turning 30 is mind blowing. It makes sense. I'm 36. Like I was 6 years old when I first heard this record. But when I look back at 30 years of listening to this record, I hear a lot of my own personal evolution as a music fan, as a listener, and it all goes back to the first time I heard this record. So throw this on if you've never heard it, and I will be right there with you. I'll be listening to those 22 unreleased tracks to try to find clues and bits and pieces of what the band was going for as they were building this masterpiece.
I'm hoping that some of those songs are maybe live snippets from Zoo TV. Like, it blows my mind that there's still no way to listen to a live version of Mysterious Ways, I think, at all, other than like YouTube and or some DVDs. I mean, for a band as big as U2, as popular as U2, the sheer lack of official live albums in their discography is kind of mind-blowing.
It is.
I mean, what? I think it's like Under a Blood Red Sky and that's it? Like I'm not counting like fan club releases or DVDs. Like, I'm thinking of just going to the store and you say, I want a U2 live record. You can't really get one.
Yeah, I think that the only other one is a technicality. It's the Wide Awake in America EP that includes a live version of Bad. And there's parts from Rattle and Hum that have live tracks. But I think you're right. Like, the only like solidly live album that is released that you can listen to on Spotify is Under Blood Red Sky.
There was a reissue, I forget of what, in part of the Super Deluxe Edition. I think it had a show from the Elevation Tour.
Yeah, there was a really good show from Boston. But that and like the Chicago Vertigo Tour, like both of those were just released on DVD. I don't think that they actually put those out on like an actual album release.
Yeah, which is a shame because I would like to have an easy non-YouTube way to hear the Mysterious Ways, like the extra slide guitar jam that the Edge shreds on his Rickenbacker Sunburst, like Roger McGuinn and the Byrds. But yeah, who knows? In any event, looking forward to that. I'll probably pull the trigger on the vinyl because I don't have that record on vinyl and I would like to have it. So,
all right, so we had some late breaking news this week that we wanted to cover before we depart for the holiday. Indie director Marty Scorsese, yeah. Renowned director of such films as The Irishman, Raging Bull, Goodfellas, which may be my personal favorite movie of all time. It's like the most rewatchable movie that's ever been made. The Departed, Gangs of New York. You know who I'm talking about. Casino, Taxi Driver. Did he do Taxi Driver? Was that not him?
I don't think he did Taxi Driver. I know Taxi Driver.
That was De Niro, but it wasn't.
I don't think it was Scorsese.
Mean Streets. I mean, the list goes on. I don't know if you guys have heard of any of these movies. I've seen them all. They're quite good. He just announced that he's going to be doing a biopic on one Jerome Garcia, starring the super bad actor Jonah Hill, who's also appeared in other movies such as Moneyball, The Wolf of Wall Street, and he's done quite well.
He's a very good actor, no two ways about it. Yeah,
quite good.
When I first heard this news, I was basically I had a split thought. My first thought was, oh, that's cool. I like The Grateful Dead. I like Scorsese movies. And I like Jonah Hill. Cool beans. The other thought was, can't you just let the man be dead? And not gratefully dead, just like dead. Will I go see this movie? Of course I will. But I think a lot of whether or not it's actually good obviously depends on the scriptwriters. And there is so many Grateful Dead biographies, so much documentation. I mean, God, this is one of the most documented bands in the universe. So why not have a biopic, you know?
Yeah, I don't think I had any sort of split thoughts. I'm all in. I was all in from the moment it was announced. I think that Jerry deserves a biopic, and Martin Scorsese is one of the most trustworthy directors that we could hand the reins to make something that is both brutally honest, funny, endearing, rewatchable, kind of you can eat it up like fun-sized Snickers bars. I mean, it's just, this is the type of movie I feel like will be, oh, it's on Netflix. I just need to watch it here in the next, you know, I'm going to watch it for the next 30 minutes while I'm just hanging out on my couch at 11 o'clock at night. Or I want to go and line up and see that movie again and get a big bowl of popcorn and watch it in the theaters. Like, I feel like I haven't been this excited about a movie since Adam McKay announced that he was doing Vice starring Christian Bale, which I absolutely loved, documenting the life of Dick Cheney. What a fascinating movie. I feel like I'm as excited for this as I was for that. Maybe Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, those two movies from late 18, early 19, really, really got me. But I'm so all in on this. And I think the biggest question I have is, what era or eras are they going to focus on The Grateful Dead? I'm going to put you on the spot here. What do you think this movie is going to encompass? Like, give me your five bullet points of events that we're going to cover in this movie.
In terms of the era, if I was a betting man, I would say it probably starts in maybe the early 60s, going way back as far when Garcia was like a young banjo player giving banjo lessons and hanging out in the Haight-Ashbury and just being like a beatnik, and then kind of putting the band together and going up to like 1970 with like Working Man's Dead / American Beauty. I don't think he's going to get into the 80s or even the 90s. You know, I have enough faith in Scorsese that he's going to take it seriously to make it entertaining and steer clear of the biopic cliches. Whereas a movie like, say, what was the one, the Ray Charles movie with Jamie Foxx, like you're not going to see any scenes of like Jerry doing a works and guys running in and being like, you don't want anything to do with this shit, Phil. Like, don't ruin your life like I did. You're not going to have any of that.
It's interesting. I don't really see a story there that like is compelling over like 2.5 hours on the screen. I feel like Scorsese just thrives at telling the American story through an individual character. And I think about like Goodfellas. I think about The Irishman, just like two examples of him taking like 40 or 50 years of American history and telling it through like one individual. I feel like Jonah Hill, just from like a physical standpoint, can evolve and adapt with young Garcia to late 70s Garcia to late 80s, early 90s Garcia to even end of life Garcia. I feel like he has that like physical structure that he could, you know, have the big chops. He could have the salt and pepper hair that's like flowing back in Egypt, and he could even go gray and look like Jerry did in the 90s. I don't know. That's kind of how I see this, that it's going to be like little bits and pieces, almost the way that Goodfellas was built, where you follow these characters across like 40 years and see kind of the arc of their life, and almost like it tells the story of an American rock icon and like the fall from grace of one. I feel like it's going to get controversial in its ugliness in terms of like showing, like I could almost see this movie having more time spent in the 90s than any other period.
Really?
Because there's just like a lot of, there's such like a Scorsese interest in Fall from Grace. And that's where I see this going, but who knows? I think it's gonna be fascinating one way or the other. You almost think of like the way that Goodfellas ended with Henry Hill in that, you know, stucco, just like new build American house in the late 80s. Schnook. It's just an average schnook eating egg noodles and ketchup. And, you know, right next to him, like another new build is being built, and he's just like a part of the American suburban sprawl.
That'd be hilarious if they end it that way. And then like, then you see Mo, and you see Fish, and you see String Cheese Incident.
I don't know if Jerry's going to.
And it ends with Goose.
Jerry Garcia would pass on August 9th, 1995, but the torch was carried by Fish.
The torch was carried.
And Mo, and for a brief period in time. And the light is still shining through Rick and Peter and Trevor and Ben. Sorry.
Oh God! So many possibilities. We're psyched. We're so psyched.
I can't wait. I just hope. Last thing I'll say is, I just hope that he figures out a way, like he always does, to put either Gimme Shelter or Monkey Man in this movie about the Grateful Dead. Would be amazing.
Yeah, that was the big joke. Is that it's a Grateful Dead movie? It's only going to have Rolling Stones songs.
We also have, before we get to big releases in Osiris Media, we have another quick birthday celebration. Today, this episode is coming out on November 22nd. It is the 24th birthday of one of the greatest Fish shows of all time, 11/22/1997 from Hampton Coliseum. And we should also, we'd be remiss if we did not shout out happy birthdays to 11/17/1997, 11/19/1997, and 11/21/1997. We'll continue to celebrate fall 1997 in every way possible as the drop moves into late November and early December. But man, what a run. I go back and I listen to the highlights every year, and I'm just like, just blown away.
Fine, fine vintage.
So before we get to the big discussion of the week, Dave, what do you recommend from Osiris Media?
So there's a podcast that we have not discussed on the drop before. It's very interesting. It's called The Tapes Archive. And what it is, it's archival releases. It's unreleased interviews with musicians throughout the years. This is a lot of stuff from the 70s, 80s, 90s, just like surprisingly unreleased stuff that was buried. I don't know exactly the guy behind it, where he gets these things or what archives he's looking for, but there was a really fascinating interview with Neil Peart from Rush from 1994. which I enjoy listening to. But the most recent edition of the Tapes Archive is an interview with Brad Delp, who was recently deceased, who's the lead singer of Boston. And the interview takes place in 1978. It's funny, Boston is on the cusp of releasing their second album, which, from the sounds of the interview, has been constantly delayed and delayed and delayed. I think their first record came out in 1976, and being the late 70s, you could have almost expected them to chase it with something in 77. But here we are in 78, and the second record's not out yet. And it's funny because, like, Brad Delp is almost, like, apologizing. He's saying, like, hey, we haven't done the vocals. As far as I know, it's hanging out in Tom Scholz's basement. Tom Scholz, of course, being the super, super, super perfectionist guitarist, somewhat anal retentive leader of Boston, one of those bands that the lead singer is not really the front man so much as he is a guy with a really, like, pretty voice and a really big curly do, as Brad Delp had. But no, I mean, it's pretty quick. It was only 26 minutes and just kind of like an interesting snapshot of a band gearing up to put out their second album, and just how hilarious it is that, like, 2 years is considered an eternity for a new release in the late 70s. So, yeah, check out the interview. And really, I think there's probably at least like 50, 60 Tapes Archives episodes at this point, and each of them are fascinating in their own way. So check it out.
Yeah, absolutely love that podcast. And there's always, like, insights and moments where, like, I hear interviews with artists from the past where I'm like, man, I just learned something completely new. I can't believe that we have that content. It's really, really cool. I'm going to recommend a show that the trailer was just released for, but the show should be out here at least, I believe, the week that this comes out. That is Litz, My Own Worst Enemy. It's a upcoming podcast here from Osiris Media, produced by the phenomenal Brad Stratton. I was on a couple initial calls for this show and heard I think two of these episodes thus far, really fantastic and just fascinating deep dive into one of the most contagious pop hits of the last 30 years, a song that was everywhere for the summer of 1999 and has been everywhere again in a variety of ways, be it in movie soundtracks, video games, guitar band, karaoke machines, jukeboxes in dive bars, sporting events, what name it. This song has been everywhere over the last 30 years. It's one of those songs that, like, you hear the opening riff and you just know exactly what it is the minute it comes on. Brad did a number of really fascinating and fantastic interviews with the members of Lit, talking about, they were a band for about 15 years before this song came out and were just kind of like living off of...
I had no idea.
I didn't either before really? This started. Yeah, they formed in the mid-80s. They were just kind of like a band in Orange County playing shitty clubs, not making a ton of money, figuring out ways to survive off of, you know, Doritos and water and, you know, driving with just like enough gas in the tank to get to the studio and then hoping that they could push their car back to the gas station. I mean, just like roughing it, living as like close to the poverty line as possible while following this dream to be rock stars. And suddenly it happened, all based off of this one song. And so it's kind of that. That's it. So it's a really interesting dive into the power of a single song while also showcasing like what it takes for a band to strike that gold and like have that moment where like, oh my God, everybody wants to hear our song. But then also what happens after that. And Lit has a new record coming out. And so there's a lot of conversation around like the band's evolution in the 20 plus years since the song came out. Just a really fascinating dive into the power of a song and what it means for a band's arc, regardless where they go. Kind of brings up the idea of like, I guess one hit wonders in terms of, you know, what that actually means from the band's perspective, which is always a really fascinating subject in rock music, but incredibly well produced, great interviews, great perspective on pop music, on punk music in the late 1990s. And I just cannot recommend it enough to our listeners. So highly recommend everyone check out the Tapes Archive, as well as Litz, My Own Worst Enemy. And with that, we're going to get to the big discussion. So, as we mentioned earlier in the episode, it is the Monday before Thanksgiving. It's a busy week for everyone. We wanted to keep things simple. You're either traveling to go see family, or you're preparing the brine or the dry rub for your turkey. Maybe you're smoking turkey for the first time and you're kind of stressed out about that. You just need something a little laid back, a little bit easier. You know, we've been stressing you guys out in the past few weeks with all these conversations about Billboard music charts and the war on drugs, so much intensity above the world. And we just wanted to give you just, you know, some nice comfort food for this week. And so we want to talk about autumnal jammage. What is autumnal jammage? It's a music you want to hear when the leaves have fallen, you're wrapped up in a cardigan, maybe strolling with a pumpkin spice latte, the air is crisp, kind of smell of pre-winter is in the air. There's maybe a little bit of a fog. The sun is hanging out about halfway up in the sky, even though it's about 11 o'clock in the morning. Maybe it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Who knows? You're just kind of strolling, embracing the time of year, and you want something that is going to make you feel warm, cozy, bring back those nostalgic vibes of being a kid around the holidays. Dave, what are you listening to? What are you hanging with at this time of year?
I'm going to talk about a relatively new album to start things, actually. This is an album by it's an individual. It's a guy, his name is Stefan Beck, but he goes by the nom de rock Golden Brown. So Golden Brown, he's based out of Colorado. He put out an album a few weeks ago, new record called Gems and Minerals. It's all instrumental. This is basically best described as, I think, like American pastoral folk music. There's a lot of pick guitar, there's atmospheric synths, there's banjos. I'm pretty sure he does almost all of it himself. And this is one of those records, we're talking autumn. This is when you're walking through the forest. There's like the leaves have largely fallen from the trees. Maybe you hear a babbling brook in the background, kind of like maybe 3:30 in the afternoon, the sun is like going to start to go down. There's a deer. The deer comes up to you and eats out of your hand. And that's like the feeling I get from listening to this Golden Brown record. The prior one he put out, I think, 2 years ago, the name which escapes me, was also very good. But I know we've talked about the artist in our podcast before, Matt LaJoy and his label Flower Room. This record's not, it doesn't come out on Flower Room, but it's kind of in, definitely pulls bark off the same tree as the kind of thing you can just put on and zone out. And this one feels especially good and fall-like and varied to me. Brian put some records here. I'm actually going to piggyback off of one of his. He said, The National, Trouble Will Find Me, a band that we talked a lot about on the podcast before, but they've kind of, I don't think they're on a hiatus right now exactly, but there's been, you know, the Destiners did a lot of work with Taylor Swift. There's Big Red Machine. Matthew Berninger put out a solo record. The last official National record, I think, came out, and I want to say May of 2019, being I'm Easy to Find. Good record, but it kind of feels like we haven't heard from the National in a while. I'm sure hopefully they come back in 2022-23, but until then, of all their records, Trouble Will Find Me kind of feels the most like walking through New York in the fall at 4:45 when it's just starting to get dark. Things are crisp. Maybe you're walking with your kid in one hand. Maybe you got a scarf on. But that definitely brings the fall vibes in a way that is somewhat darker than the Golden Brown record, but still very welcome.
Yeah, the Golden Brown record is just incredible fall album. I was listening to that yesterday, and I agree with you. I mean, that's why I wrote it down. Trouble Will Find Me is like, it's the most national record. There's no BS, there's no synths, there's no kind of weird sounds. Just like, here we are. This is how every one of us sounds without too many effects, without too many bells and whistles. These are just some of these are our best crafted songs at this point in time. And that sound tends to sound like coming out of a bar in New York City. You know, leaves are still on the ground. It's not winter. We're not there. It's not snow. It's not ice, but it's like a chill in the air and the sun's going down a little bit earlier. It's pretty incredible. I tend to think about this time of year. I was saying this earlier in the show, like my uncle's house. I wish I could like paint a picture of it for everyone, 'cause it screams Thanksgiving to me. There's like exposed brick. There's big wooden beams. It had a really awesome like range, cooker and like, you know, huge restaurant grade stove. He had amazing couches and like nice little bar upstairs in this room that had a big ceiling. Like it was an absolutely magical place to hang out in late November.
You're describing my grandparents' house, the second floor of that house, the ratty couches, the bar with alcohol that probably predates my parents, but we didn't drink that alcohol. It was always a little bit too hot. The thermostat was a bit too high. The television was, I think, the same TV I watched the Mets win the World Series on in 1986. But it's just, I look forward to it every year, you know.
Yeah, and there's three records that just completely bring back that space to me. One is Neil Young's Silver and Gold. I remember when that record came out in 2000. I was 15, and I just distinctly remember that Thanksgiving kind of just being like a dipshit 15-year-old not wanting to go to family Thanksgiving, but literally having no choice because I couldn't drive and I wasn't of legal age to decide such things. Showing up at my uncle's house and like all the magic of Thanksgiving coming back to me, and this album just playing constantly throughout that weekend. The Beatles anthology that came out in 1994. I was 9 years old, and I just have very vivid memories of our entire family sitting on couches, like everyone just like arms around each other, so much love in the room, watching the Beatles anthology and like falling in love with the Beatles all over again and learning things I'd never learned about them. And then Tom Petty's Wildflowers, which came out, I believe, in 1996. Is that correct? 95, 96?
94.
94 as well. Okay. But that album, anytime we were at my uncle's house around the holidays, that album came on at least two or three times. And just one of those records, you press play, you hear those first opening guitar chords of Wildflowers, and you're just like sucked back into nostalgia, and you are not taking that record off until it's over. And I just discovered there's a great documentary about the making of Wildflowers. There was a bunch of footage that was discovered about a year or so ago, and it just showcases Tom Petty as he's building this album, as he's creating it. He's working with Rick Rubin, and really cool interviews with Tom talking about just like getting to the idea of what is a song and trying to throw away the notion of like an album needing to have this larger thematic structure and in place, because they're kind of pushing that idea away. They have this just incredible structure of a record that feels like, to cop a name from a song off the album, it feels like A Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah, that is a serious fall record. I agree. Hearing the opening licks on that album kind of brings in the image like really brown leaves falling to the ground. This is late autumn. This isn't like so much when things are in bloom. This is kind of like autumn sort of going into winter.
Yeah.
Thanksgiving, in this case, Hanukkah's over this year. Thanksgiving segues directly into Hanukkah, which is good because I get to see some Yola Tango shows early. I mean, God, Yola Tango, I can hear the heart beating as one. That's kind of a layup because it's got the song that has the song Autumn Sweater. But even from the kind of like yellow and orange artwork motif on that record, just to how kind of like side B with songs like 1 a.m. Again, The Lie and How We Told It, We're an American Band, that really gets some of the late autumn vibes going for me.
Yeah, that is definitely an autumn. And the next record, and then Nothing Turned Itself Inside Out, feels like November to me. Ooh. In just like such a brilliant way. Even though it came out in February and like is like clearly works in midwinter. I discovered that record in the fall of 2009 was the first time I heard it. And it just will always bring me back to that late fall vibe. But, another record of theirs, Fake Book, I think is what it's called. The all acoustic covers really feels
all acoustic covers. Yeah.
Really feels like late fall.
Yeah. That's all acoustic covers of, dudes with issues like Daniel Johnston, Cat Stevens. I forget.
Couple other records I would recommend from, a couple from the 80s. I've been finding that like I fade between two areas in terms of music that I want right now. One, really warm sounding acoustic guitars, and two, gated drums and synths, which it seems to be, I just want gated drums and synths at any time of the year, but I've justified them as late fall records as well. From the 80s, Dire Straits, Brothers in Arms. Like the second you hear that, just so far away, it just feels like I'm with my family around Thanksgiving. So Brothers in Arms, Springsteen's Tunnel of Love. You get this mix between Springsteen playing his acoustic guitar to Springsteen playing synths and gated drums. And then U2's appropriately named October. One of their best records, and a record that when you put that on in the late fall, it just works perfectly.
I think also we have listed The Walkman, Lisbon, which is interesting to me. That's one of those records that's kind of like the lost Walkman record, because that was the one that came in between their career peak, You and Me, and then their swan song, at least to this point, being Heaven. Lisbon's a good record. It definitely, it kind of feels slightly lower stakes than some of the other Walkman records, but it definitely, it can kind of feel like walking around Portugal.
Yeah, and it just got that loose vibe that I think kind of caters music at this time of year. Like the song Stranded just sounds to me like November. Bill Callahan's Apocalypse, just in terms of the acoustic guitar vibes, that record, I put that on at this time of year and I'm just lost. Bon Iver's self-titled record, kind of a fusion between singer-songwriter and synths. Mark McGuire's Living With Yourself, one of my favorite records from 2010, as well as Deer Hunter's Fading Frontier. Talk about a lost record for a great band. Deer Hunter's Fading Frontier was their follow-up to Monomania, and was kind of the overlooked album from the band. That came out 2 weeks after my son was born in the fall of 2015 and was like a warm sweater for me during that period in time. And I listened to this record just constantly in like new dad mornings and stressed out evenings and moments where I was tired and had no idea what was going on and my life had completely changed. This record like sounds like the fall to me in such a perfect way. So one last thing to leave you with. Actually, two, because it's a period of excessive eating and consumption. Two films I tend to watch during this week on repeat, on loop, and I'm so grateful that my wife is a fan of both of these as well. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, the 1986 buddy comedy featuring Steve Martin and John Candy, in which Steve Martin is trying to get home for Thanksgiving and is accosted by John Candy, and the two of them travel from New York to Wichita. I think it's Wichita, trying to get back to the suburbs of Chicago. Great John Hughes movie. I probably watch it 8 times during the week of Thanksgiving. It's just incredible. Great 80s soundtrack. And then I don't even feel like I have to recommend this because you're all probably going to watch it anyway, but The Last Waltz. There's a moment on Wednesday evening, the night before Thanksgiving, when you're allowed to put The Last Waltz on, and when you start to hear the and you see Rick Danko explain Cutthroat and then he breaks the pool cues And then we get the band coming on stage. Robbie Robertson's got all that cigarette smoke coming out of his head. And he goes, "You're still here. We'll play one more song." And we go into "Don't Do It." And they get like, you know, the pause for like every single band member as they're playing. Oh my God, man. And then like every artist that comes through it, it's the absolute greatest. So if you haven't watched The Last Waltz, which is crazy if you're listening to this podcast and haven't, please do it, as well as Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Not even Van Morrison's recent Brainworms tour turn of being weird and anti-vax and putting out these epic double-length albums where he does everything from anti-Semitism to anti-vax. I don't know. None of that will ever take away his big high leg kick in The Last Waltz. So that's the kind of Van Morrison that I want to envision for the rest of my life.
Hey, Van the Man. All right, we are going to leave you with a new record. You're still recommending new records. We're going to be recommending new records on end. However long this podcast goes on, we will be recommending you new records. You can guarantee that. We're getting close to the time of year where we compile our list. Dave, do you have a list yet?
I don't. This is, well, we can talk about this at some point, but 2021 is kind of weird in that, God, I've listened to a lot of Phish in 2021, and there aren't that many albums I have been over the moon over. A lot of good stuff, but relative to past years, the list is going to be more diffuse, I think. Less ordered, more kind of just like a confetti can of stuff I've been listening to. So I don't have one yet.
I have a list, but I do agree with you. I think it's going to prove to be an interesting top albums of the year discussion when we get to that point sometime here within the next month. But regardless of that list, I am still discovering new records, and I think you are as well. But I definitely feel like Phish overtook this year. We kind of need a podcast that takes Phish music and tells us what else to listen to, because nobody's doing that right now. But
no one's done that. No one ever did that.
No one will ever do that. But
could be useful.
Could be useful. But that said, we're each going to recommend a new album. Dave, what is your new record that you want to recommend for us?
This is an album from a band based out of Brooklyn called Nation of Language. The album is called A Way Forward. So this record, it's, I guess you could call it, the biggest influence is 80s synth pop and some British post-punk. I kind of lumped this in with like 80s British sophistopop bands, maybe like some Simply Red, some Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, definitely some Level 42, best known for that song that goes... You know, one of those songs that you know it if you heard it. It's kind of like there's also some Kraftwerk. There's an emphasis on synths and drum machines and plucked bass lines, but there's also some very good songwriting afoot. But I would say I think it's pretty, the songs are 3-4 minutes. It comes in bite-sized chunks. And anybody who's into like the 80s synth pop and or some post-punk like drum machine bands that I have talked about, they'll like this because it's definitely it's comfort food. I think this is their second album. They might have put one out last year. It's either second or third. Relatively prolific in that I think the albums come out like 1 year after each other. But this is for the 80s synth pop vibes, I would recommend this highly. And let's listen to a song. Let's listen to the fourth song on the record called Miranda.
Yeah. All you gotta say, Dave, is 80s synth pop, and I'm in. I'm gonna definitely have to check that record out.
Heck yeah, 80s synth pop.
I am going to recommend an album and an artist that close listeners of our former podcast and of this podcast will be shocked to hear that I am recommending. I never thought it was going to happen. I did not care for anything that this artist had really done previously. I did not get her. Songwriting never really appealed to me. The guitar work never really appealed to me. I had so many friends. I think Dave probably was one of them, but like, so many friends send me her record and be like, oh, you got to listen to this song. You got to get into this. Nothing clicked. And it wasn't until about 2 months ago that friend of the pod, Sam Timberg, who's probably very excited that I'm giving him a shout out here because he sent me the song Ray Street by Courtney Barnett and said, you should listen to this. And I said, fine, man, I will listen to it. I do not really care for much of Courtney Barnett's music. I don't really care for any of it. None of it appealed to me. And I put it on and I was like, wow, that might have been the song that finally made sense about what Courtney Barnett is capable of doing. And so her latest record, Things Take Time, came out, I want to say about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. And I gave it
2 weeks,
two weeks ago, and I gave it a spin, and it opens up with the song Ray Street, so I was already hooked. The second track on the record definitely did not hook me, which is interesting because apparently you really like it, Dave. But I kept listening. I said, I'm just going to give this a chance. And by the end of it, I think I'm, if not fully convinced, I'm at least bought in. There still are moments on this record that annoy the hell out of me. I really don't like her rhyming scheme. I really don't like the like lackadaisical, slacker-esque approach to songwriting and life. It just does nothing for me. Some of her guitar licks, cool, don't really move the needle for me. But there's enough songs on here midway through the record, and the album is bookended by two songs that I just absolutely loved, Ray Street and Oh the Night, that I just couldn't help but recommend other people check this out. Maybe more of it will appeal to you than appealed to me. I think I'm probably like 65% into this record, which aligns with the Pitchfork review, which was a 6.5. It feels that way. It's good, does some stuff for me, doesn't totally convince me that I need to go back and do a deep dive into her career. I feel like I've heard enough to know where I'm at, but I really appreciated the kind of approach to building a song. She does some really great work with Stella Mozgawa, who's her drummer and her producer, who's worked with Warpaint, Kate LeBon, and Kurt Vile. Just adds some really interesting soundscapes and really interesting ideas throughout this record that I think end up just making it really nice little statement for her. And I've already returned to it more than I have any previous Courtney Barnett album. And I feel like I would recommend you all check it out and listen to it to see what you take away from it. So here I am in the year of 2021 recommending a Courtney Barnett album. Never expected to do it. I know I've thrown out some backhanded compliments. I apologize. I'm just trying to be as honest as possible. I do recommend this record, though. It is a great little record that also, final thing I'll say about it, I put the record on as I was pulling out of my driveway to take my kids to school, and the record ended as I was pulling into my driveway after taking my kids to school. They don't go very far. It's a record that gets to the point and gets through it in a very, very short order so that you feel like you're able to listen to this, consume it, enjoy it, and move on. And hey, as a young dad, Dave and I have talked at length about a sub 40-minute record, just perfect, perfect stuff. And this does that. So we're going to listen to the closing track off this record, one of my favorite songs of the year, Oh the Night.
Oh the Night. I don't really know.
Just briefly picking up on the Courtney Barnett thread before we close out. Brian, have you heard the song History Eraser?
I have not heard the song. I probably have. What album does it come
on? That's on her first EP. History Eraser is still her best song. That's like, that. I mean, I like the new Courtney Barnett record. I did not like the second one. Tell Me How You Really Feel. I thought the first one was good. I kind of burnt out on her a bit quickly, but I have been enjoying this new one because it's more in the vein of her classics like History Eraser, Avant Gardener, the song Depressed off her first album. So yeah, I'm kind of, I agree that I was not a fan of Tell Me How You Really Feel, but the new one's kind of got me back on board somewhat. But yeah, God, check a History Eraser. That has to be done. Before we end, just say that the Level 42 song I was singing very badly was Something About You. I had a brain cramp there for a sec. That's the one most people know. If you enjoy Level 42 Something About You, you will enjoy the Nation of Language album, A Way Forward, that I had discussed. But we're actually going to be taking off next week because we'll be with our families for Thanksgiving. Home for the weekend. You guys could all use a bit of a break, but we'll be coming back all cylinders firing in the first week of December. So, if you've gotten this far, happy Thanksgiving. Enjoy it with your families or however you enjoy it. Thank you for listening, and then come back in 2 weeks for another episode of The Drop.
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of The Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, "Man, I gotta hear that." Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.